When it's all said and done, I'll be 40 before I know it. With a 40 on a porch telling stories. With a bottle of Jack, two grandkids in my lap. Babysitting for Haley. While Haley's out getting smacked. Getting smacked. Getting smacked.
G Patty leading the charge. The pass is down deep to Goat Patty. Goat Patty passes baseline to Beef Patty. Beef Patty shoots from downtown at the buzzer. And bingo! It's in! It's in! Carob Patties wins the game and is now the world champions! The number one in Montreal. Come on down to 9550 Jean Milot in LaSalle for the best patties, roadies, jerk chicken, and more. Or call us at 438-387-4004. Carob Patties, the champions of Montreal.
Hey, this is Roxanne Shante, and of course you know I am listening to CKUT 90.3.
Hear me recite. I'm dedicated to all of those that bite.
Welcome to Enough is More Than a Feast here on CKUT 90.3 FM, CKUT.ca. Got 2 hours for you coming up till 4 a.m. This first hour, we're going to be listening to an unreleased studio session between Hollowbody and Anabasi and myself, a drone demo from last winter. And I'm going to be reading text called Life, War, and Politics After the George Floyd Rebellion, which I heard at an online conference a week and a half ago. It was called The Undercommons and Destituent Power Between Pandemic and the Uprising. And it was given by, this talk was given by members of the Vitalist International. I think it's kind of relevant and interesting for this time. I hope you're comfortable this first snowy moment of our deep winter upcoming. Hope you and yours are safe and cared for, making it through all right. So without much further ado, I'm going to read this text. The second hour, there's a bunch of music that I put together. I'll come back on to announce some of it at the top of the 3 o'clock hour. But first, here we go. Life, War, and Politics After the George Floyd Rebellion. Section 1. We live after the George Floyd Rebellion, not merely in the midst of a global pandemic, not merely in the midst of the breakdown of the American political system, not merely in the midst of a questioned election, not simply in the time of what many would call the Black Lives Matter movement, but after the 2020 summer rebellion. The rebellion of this summer manifested as a response, and not importantly, as a reaction to the murder of George Floyd. From there, it took on the contours of roughly five modes. First, the immediate reaction to the death of George Floyd Jr. in the final days of May, culminating in widespread unrest and the burning of the Third Precinct by thousands of protesters. Second, nearly a week of massive looting of shopping districts and rioting in city and town centers in hundreds of municipalities across the United States and elsewhere, especially at the beginning of June. In this phase, millions of people seized the time and/or space necessary to freely construct a proportionate response to Floyd's death. In the third mode, beginning with the killing of Rayshard Brooks in Atlanta, local insurrections responded to police killings in Rochester, Kenosha, Lafayette, Louisville, and elsewhere. These forms did not renegotiate power across entire cities, but they did allow black people and other people of conscience to retain control over political and ethical priorities within their context, keeping police and city governments alike on the retreat. Contemporaneously, but nevertheless in an additional fourth mode, protesters began to construct autonomous zones in city centers and to wage iconoclastic attacks on Confederate and colonial monuments. This allowed protesters to broaden the scope of the movement after police were indicted in Minneapolis, and to retain the tactical initiative even as the crowds diminished in size. In the fifth mode, starting around July 4th, seemingly focused crowds of prepared and experienced fighters carry out targeted attacks or willfully engage police. This coincided with ritualized and dramatic street battles between protesters and police in Richmond, Seattle, and most famously, Portland. Among the attacks were the burning of the construction site of the Juvenile Detention Center in Seattle, attacks on various police and law enforcement headquarters in Atlanta, the torching of courthouses in Oakland and Colorado. This mode shares commonalities with the previous modes, but represented the twilight of spatial or tactical innovations within the movement. After the end of July, we argue, we see the undeniable waning of mass activity affiliated with the George Floyd Rebellion. At the same time, upheaval has by no means ceased entirely. Occasional flare-ups and explosions, typical of the third mode of the rebellion, are still taking place, as we saw in Philadelphia in the week before the election, following the killing of Walter Wallace. Idris Robinson has said, quote, "A leaderless and multiracial rebellion did in fact take place," end quote. Yes, we elaborate that the George Floyd Rebellion took place means that an antagonistic autonomous movement has exposed the biopolitical project of Western civilization by attacking it. Section 2. Within struggles, the terrain and terms, the sides and stakes of the antagonism are themselves also under constant contestation. The appraisal of forces, the calibration of risks, the clash of infantry, all of this could be understood not generically as the factors of a battle, but as the anatomy of a specific conception of warfare. As the life-war continuum is consciously blurred by modern industrial states and the mobilization of public affects, anxieties, and prejudices are increasingly mobilized into a bipartisan culture war, emancipatory actors must reflect on the term of the terms, not to struggle against the opposing camps or enemies, but the terrain of unfolding hostilities itself. Western governance maintains public order by regulating, steering, facilitating, abandoning, killing, and controlling biological existence within our species and the life forms on which our species depends. What is permitted and what is possible are constantly paired. As unregulated life is consistently associated with scarcity, uncertainty, suffering, and blackness. But from both the perspective of governance and that of the governed, the biopolitical task has been upset. As David Wallace Wells and other climate analysts have shown, we have exited the so-called human climate niche. The existence of our species on this planet for roughly 350,000 years has taken place within a specific set of relatively delicate conditions that no longer seem to have a reliable future. With carbon parts per million exceeding 400, ocean acidification wiping out marine life, biodiversity collapse, and myriad sophisticated ecological problems undermining the basis for complex terrestrial existence, the possibility of fulfilling the mandate of biopolitical governance to administer, regulate, and govern life is itself called into question. At present, around 1,000 Americans per day are dying of coronavirus, with no plans in place to contain the uncontrolled spread of the disease across the territory. This summer, over 500,000 Oregonians were displaced from catastrophic wildfires that spread from California to Washington state. It is thus of little surprise that contemporary revolts adopt positions not simply regarding widespread inequalities or corruption, but against the terms of life itself, of what lives matter, of what is worth dying for. In our era, life is both the terrain and object of an ongoing conflict. But what type of conflict is this? Contemporary governance tends to transform all antagonisms, latent or sudden, into a contest of a basic shape, that between constituted groups with articulable or coherent interests and normative figures to represent those groups. And from a certain perspective, much of the events we know now as the George Floyd Rebellion can be understood in precisely these terms. For instance, after the initial days of revolt in Minneapolis, the Defund the Police program gained purchase within the media as the ostensible demand of the broader rebellion. Specialized groups constituted themselves within the movement. Armed security teams guarded autonomous zones. Organized right-wing and white supremacist militias deployed throughout the Pacific Northwest. Bands of armed anti-fascists confronted libertarian militias in Kenosha, Seattle, and Portland. The chaotic flux of the revolt is reframed, as much as it can be, as a sectarian battle between BLM or Antifa members and a right-wing specter variously described as Boogaloo Boys, Neo-Nazis, Proud Boys, or simply MAGA extremists. Vast reservoirs of feeling and energy are reimagined as intentional and organizational interiorities. This style of conflict emerges when the initiative of rebellious actors is not powerful enough to break the time or space of the ruling order and must militate within given configurations of power. And yet, a struggle over the terms of a conflict is hidden inside of every confrontation, however concealed it may be. Beyond the clash of opposing forces, there is also a struggle between concepts of victory and defeat, and over the nature of the hostility itself. Does the form of antagonism produce intractable polarizations, such that the resolution can only result in the absolute elimination of one or both parties? Does it tend to reconfigure the structure of the society around it? Or is it a conflict alongside which spectators can live? Is the battle of a paradigmatic fight between ethical opposites, the resolution of which will fundamentally alter life as we know it? If one side loses, does the other side win? Does the fighting allow for various degrees of specialization, force, violence, and creativity? Or does it tend to become more specialized, more violent, and less creative as it develops? The initial rebellion in Minneapolis, specifically as it culminated in the burning of the Third Precinct, was an example of the kind of struggle we would like to see. Not simply because of the impressive and unthinkable facts on the ground, but because of what was made possible by the arrangement of forces in the first place. Anyone who was present for those final days of May can tell you that what took place on those afternoons and evenings was a genuine youth revolt, with widespread participation also among adults and children. Having seized the free and joyous initiative over the time and space of battle, the rebels chose to make everything a festival. Skateboarders were jumping over burning piles of trash. Children were pushing carts of toys and fruit juices out of stores with their parents. Young lovers embraced in their oversized hoodies, gazing into each other's eyes as the smoking inferno behind them, the Third Precinct, cast everything in a dark orange glow. The police encountered hostile enemy forces, engaged in bitter and relentless urban guerrilla operations. The former imagined coordinated and intelligent acts of sophisticated and possibly funded commandos. In fact, the police and the rebels were not on the same block, not in the same neighborhoods, not in the same city. They weren't even in the same reality. With their preferred theater of operations, the modern metropole, reduced to a smoldering playground, and the psychological medium of their rule, consensus reality, absolutely vacated, the police wandered around the city as a desperate group of people, with sticks and tear gas and nothing more. This is precisely the kind of conflict we believe that millions of people were able to initiate for about a week. Asymmetrical, subversive activity in which unspecialized, mostly unarmed, groups composed of different ethnicities, religious affiliations, sexualities, and ages could freely utilize time, space, and infrastructure according to both the unregulated initiative of their desires and the capacities of the people around them. Throughout the rebellion, forms of low-intensity mass combat emerged as a decentralized force of frontliners, including mom blocks and dad blocks, mobilized from within their subjective spheres in a format that simultaneously subverted and challenged the normative coherence which those spheres typically rely upon. While these forms did not allow rebellious social forces to completely regain the initiative or to reimagine the theater of operations, nor to establish the kind of martial and phenomenological asymmetry reminiscent of the period of late May or early June, they did facilitate experiments in partial rearrangements of force, allowing for diverse elements to mix, and at the very least, retain autonomous initiative vis-a-vis one another. Thank you. What has become of this conflict over conflict, now that the actions of the summer seem to be waning? It now appears as a dispute over the boundaries of the political itself. In the days leading up to the election, for instance, a truck affiliated with a Trump caravan that included a local elected official fired on Black Lives Matter protesters gathered at the defaced Robert E. Lee Monument in Richmond, Virginia. At the polls, election defenders were called upon by both parties, giving the sense that the democratic institution itself is at risk. Actions undertaken in the course of the rebellion, in particular looting, arson, and the strange category of inciting a riot, are being persecuted not as politicized gestures, but as criminal activity, often described as acts of opportunism that ran parallel to the otherwise legitimate protests. The Republican Party has still not ceased to question the results of the recent election, hoping to stoke their base into a partisan contest against the legitimacy of the electoral process itself. Demonstrations during the week of the election, in Portland, in Minneapolis, in New York City, were repressed heavily by police, as drag racers and sideshow or takeover participants, a youth subculture with extensive participation in the protests this summer, were simultaneously criminalized across the country. That is all to say that the domain of legitimate politics is once again under partial police control. Both major wings of the state are engaged in unified, though apparently opposed, attacks on the free initiative of human beings. By fighting one another in seemingly escalated conflict, the two major parties hope to reconstitute one another as the paradigmatic antagonism of the present. They are doing everything they can to make us care, to make us get involved, to bring us into the process, to force us to pick one of their miserable, joyless sides. Section 3. As the basic assumptions of the Western biopolitical project are called into question from every side, the line demarcating periods of social peace from upheaval has begun to blur. Indeed, this is the peculiar conclusion required by any attentive consideration of the geographically and temporally disparate events colloquially gathered under the banner of Black Lives Matter. The mass phenomenon we have called the George Floyd Rebellion has already been subsumed under this banner in mainstream media. While a certain perspective accurately recognizes the continuity of challenges to the subordination and death of black people in the United States from 2014 to 2020, and another might equally accurately point to the continuity between the black struggles of our decades and those of the 1960s and 70s, we must also recognize that we live in a decade in which a variety of conflicts proliferate. Over the past several years, and even more so in 2020, we have seen housing struggles, struggles against immigrant detention, struggles over the border, labor strikes, teachers' movements, students' movements, prison uprisings, and even times of unrest whose political significance is difficult to ascertain, such as the unusually destructive riots in Los Angeles for the Lakers, and then for the Dodgers a few weeks ago. In our context, traditional conceptual apparatuses of revolt or revolution founder. Contemporary revolts do not represent a form of communication, do not coalesce around coherent identities to inform a new political subject, and they do not inaugurate a new universal experience of reality to be aggressively subordinated to advanced forms of algorithmic segregation. Where many may imagine an increasingly self-aware and intelligent consciousness, a consciousness represented by a specific faction of society uniquely positioned to liberate the world from its woes, we see instead the steady accumulation of small realities. Breaks and fragments tear away from an increasingly empty and meaningless center. It is in this context that we believe we share two significant notions with our presenters at this conference. The first is the affirmation of an anti-politics. That's anti with an A-N-T-E, so like before politics. Fred Moten and Stefano Harney have expressed an adjacent notion in their conception of the surround, a scene of activity and livelihood beyond the enclosure of the fort and the common of traditional politics. Here we understand a politicized life independent of its entry into or qualification by politics in its institutionalized form. What is significant here is twofold. First, it avoids postulating a political ontological task of becoming human or becoming political that enables, expresses, and reproduces the exclusive inclusion that facilitates the white supremacy of the state. Second, it harbors the possibility of shifting the site of politics away from the terrain of the contemporary governmental apparatus onto the terrain of everyday life. Related is a second idea, the affirmation of the primacy of revolt in relation to that which governs or captures it. Stefano Harney has recently stated, quote, "Insurgency is primary. Rebellion comes first. We don't rebel against the police because there is police. The police come after us if we show ourselves as that primary antagonism." End quote. How can we understand these two points, anti-politics and the primacy of revolt, in terms of this summer's rebellion? As it concerns something like an anti-politics, we understand that the rebellion mobilized lifestyles that were already to some extent present. Mutual aid networks set up to distribute food to those lacking in the pandemic became means of collecting and distributing supplies for frontliners. In some places, existing local bail funds grew 10 times over to support those arrested in the rebellion. neighborhood solidarities became means of organizing for safety or for attack. Roommates became frontliners.